Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And there's days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
Yes, this is episode 107 of the podcast. I am Dave, your host, still, perpetually. Thanks for listening. Today on the podcast, John Enkele, filmmaker and meditation teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. He is going to be giving a talk on the thesis, nobody likes a wet dog. What does that mean? Well, you have to listen to find out. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a fall course called Contentment in Everyday Life. And it's being co-taught by John Enkele, the very person whose talk you're about to hear. So if you enjoy this talk, definitely check out Contentment in Everyday Life. It is one of our introductory courses in our meditation curriculum. It is a five-week course beginning Thursday evening, September 22nd, and following on five Thursday evenings weekly. And for more information and to register, you can go to ny.shambhala.org and click the link on the homepage for Contentment in Everyday Life with John Enkele and his co-teacher, Dallas Itzen. And now, from a talk recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering, back in, when was this talk done? This talk was done, actually a couple of weeks ago, earlier this month in August, at our weekly Dharma gathering. Here is John Enkele.
My daughter gave me a book of poetry for my birthday a couple of weeks ago. And she read me a poem from the book to kind of give me the flavor of the poet Billy Collins. And I want to read that poem for you. It was inspired by something that another poet, Mary Oliver, said. She was being interviewed about writing poetry, how she approaches the task, who she has in mind when she writes a poem. Is there one person in particular? And in the context of that interview, this is what she said. She said, "I write poems for a stranger who will be born in some distant country hundreds of years from now." So Billy Collins, he read that interview or got wind of it somehow, and he was inspired by what she said, what Mary Oliver said about her audience, this stranger in a distant country. And he thought, well, let me write a poem for that same stranger. And so this is Billy Collins' poem, and it's entitled, "To a Stranger Born in Some Distant Country Hundreds of Years from Now." Nobody here likes a wet dog. No one wants anything to do with a dog that is wet from being out in the rain or retrieving a stick from a lake. Look how she wanders around the crowded pub tonight, going from one person to another, hoping for a pat on the head, a rub behind the ears, something that could be given with one hand without even wrinkling the conversation. But everyone pushes her away, some with a knee, others with the sole of a boot. Even the children, who don't realize she's wet until they go to pet her, push her away, then wipe their hands on their clothes. And whenever she heads toward me, I show her my palm and she turns aside. O stranger of the future, O inconceivable being, whatever the shape of your house, however you scoot from place to place, no matter how strange and colorless the clothes you may wear, I bet nobody there likes a wet dog either. I bet everybody in your pub, even the children, pushes her away. Nobody here likes a wet dog. No one likes a wet dog. The poet is saying it's a kind of instinctive human reaction. And he suggests it's true for everyone, everywhere. Even it will be true in the distant future for people not even born yet. Nobody wants to pet a wet dog and then pick up a French fry in the pub. Get away, don't come back until you've dried off. It's no harm done, no problem, except maybe for the dog, who will be a little bit disappointed. But those of us who've had dogs know that they are the embodiment of forgiveness. So it shouldn't be a problem. She'll get over it. And we, when we put our palm up and turn the dog away, we may be missing out on the chance to engage with that good energy that is coming toward us. But the poet is saying that's just how it is with us. You know, we like to keep the messiness of life at bay. As human beings, we have our preferences. We have our likes and our dislikes. And that's just the way it is. We draw toward us what we like, and we tend to push away what we don't like. That's just how we are. From a Dharma perspective, these teachings would suggest that we should stop and look at this, because what appears to be harmless, of no consequence, on the surface, if we look at it a little more deeply, we will discover the cause of our unhappiness. And that's a pretty radical assertion and a radical teaching, because on the surface, it doesn't seem quite commensurate. You know, how could a simple thing like our preferences be the cause of our suffering? But it's there. It's there in the tradition, back to the earliest days of Buddhism in Asia, 6th century. A poet wrote these lines: "The great way is not difficult. Just avoid picking and choosing. Likes and dislikes are the disease of the mind." 6th century. What an insight. Again, pretty radical. Likes and dislikes are the disease of the mind, the dis-ease of the mind. If our natural mind is open and spacious and unencumbered, and then we get involved with liking and disliking, we get involved with picking and choosing, these teachings are saying, that is the source of confusion. Ignorance, ultimately, suffering. So it's not saying that we never have to make choices. It's not saying that as adults who are mature, as parents perhaps, who are conscientious about raising our children, as responsible citizens, it's not saying that there aren't important choices that we need to make. We're in the midst of such a critical time right now in our country. So it's not dismissing the fact that there are decisions that are important and that matter. Rather, it's talking about how our mind can be overtaken when it gets weighed down with opinions, with likes and dislikes, because we can't see clearly. We can't see the truth of the moment clearly when we're caught up already in our opinions and evaluations and judgments. I was over the weekend talking to my wife about what I was thinking of saying tonight, and she said, "Oh, you're talking about falling into a snarky mindset." And I never heard her say snarky before. And I've never said it. I wasn't even sure what it meant. But she said, it has to do with this inner critic that is always at the ready, always prepared to bounce on the next thing, evaluating, criticizing, judging. Many of us live with this kind of snarky mindset, but we don't know it. We're not aware, we're not conscious of it, unless we have a way of turning the light inward, looking at our own interior life, like meditation practice. A few weeks ago, I heard Judy Leaf talk a little bit about this, and in another context. She's a Shambhala teacher who's been teaching since the 1970s and very familiar with the teachings and was close to the founder of the Shambhala teachings, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And anyway, she used this image that was helpful to me that I like to pass on to you. She said, it's like starting with a blank page and then we draw a line down the middle of it. And on one side we put what we like, and on the other side we put what we don't like. So the dog that is wet from having just come out of the pond, probably smelly too, a little bit. Wet dogs tend to be smelly, goes in the dislike column and will stay there until she dries off. So likes and dislikes, simple preferences, it doesn't seem like a big deal. But if you stand back and just look at how much effort and energy we put into trying to figure out how to rid ourselves of what we don't like so that we'll be left with just what pleases us, a life of pleasure, comfort, striving for that point when we can get everything lined up just the way we want it, no matter how superficial or tenuous or momentary that may be. Still, so much of our psychic energy goes into striving for just that. And we may get them lined up just the way we want them, but it doesn't last. It doesn't last. And then all of our psychic energy goes into wishing things could be some other way. How much of our life do we spend wishing things could be other than they are? Discontent robs us of our aliveness when we become preoccupied with dividing our life up into this is good, but that's bad, or not good enough, or it's never good enough. Separating and labeling. And it can play out in ways that are destructive and dangerous, even for a society. If you look at where we are now, you know, I divide my life down the middle, and on this side, I'm over here, and you're over there. And I bring my group along with me. So we are in this column. You and your group are over in that other column. I'm much more comfortable over here in my column with my group. I feel safe over here. I feel my group is trustworthy because my group is right. But your group is not so right. And it's not trustworthy. In fact, it's unworthy. It's even a threat to me and my group. A couple weeks ago, there was a piece in the New York Times reporting on some very, it was lifting up some research that it saw as being very important. And the research was done, I think, at Ohio University by some sociologists there. It was very thorough and very revealing. And it was about how we perceive the other. People in the other group. And there were three significant findings. One, it said, we attribute the other group's positive actions to random chance and circumstance, whereas their bad actions are seen as a reflection of that group's core nature. Another thing, very fascinating, says we perceive members of the other group as capable of experiencing only primitive emotions. And what are they? Anger and happiness. But they're incapable of experiencing more sophisticated emotions like sorrow, guilt, nostalgia. They don't even feel guilty for the wrong that they do, bordering on pathological. And then finally, the whole group is blamed for the radical actions of a few members. So we see how this dividing line that we draw down through the center of our experience becomes thicker and more solid. And we end up with us, them, good, bad, right, wrong, winners, losers, who will live, who will die, ultimately. So, this was the claim of the Buddha at the very beginning, that we create our world, and meditation helps us see just what that process is. We become aware of how we create our world by dividing and categorizing. And it's a very subtle process. But we can sit on our cushion, and it opens up to us, this process. It's as if we're deconstructing it, but without even intending to do so, because that is just what we see. It's built in to the practice. And what we see is, and what is very useful when we carry it off the cushion into the rest of our lives, we see this process of how we notice differences, because we are different. Each of us is an individual, and we're all different. Things are different. Events are different. It's all different. It's all very individual. But we don't stop there. One person different from another, noticing that. We begin comparing, evaluating, weighing one over against the other, categorizing. I like her, but I don't like him. And the things and people we like, we draw toward us, and the things and people we don't like, we push away. And this is how we begin to create our world. This is how we construct it, through, as the Dharma teaching says, grasping and pushing away. That's the dynamic. And yet it begins with this seemingly harmless, get away from me, don't come back till you dry off. So these teachings say that we live in a world of dualities. Duality, and that's the problem. And not only do we live in a world of dualities, but that world of dualities is a world of projection. So that instead of experiencing life as it is, in its freshness, in its spontaneity, in its individuality, we are experiencing our own projections. That is what we see reflected back to us. My ideas of who you are, my preferences, my biases, are being reflected back to me. And so in that way, I have constructed a personal world. It's my personal world. And of course, everybody's doing it. And the Dharma is saying, look at this personal world. It's a delusion. Why is it a delusion? It's a delusion because It's happening in our head. It's not real. My opinion of you is not who you are. It's just a thought. And that holds true for all my opinions and viewpoints about everyone and everything. Those that I cling to. My viewpoint is just my viewpoint. It could be partially true in that it is part of what can be seen, part of what I see from where I stand, but it only includes a little piece. And how accurate that is, the extent to which that is a projection, that's yet to be determined. So my viewpoint is just what I can see from where I stand. There's so much that is excluded. The billions of people alive in this moment, participating in this very moment with us right now, how much of that are we aware of? Not to mention the infinitely vast web of causes and conditions that go to making this moment and making each of us in all our individuality and all our uniqueness. So our perspective at any one moment is just that. It's just our perspective. It's just what we see from where we stand. So much is missing. And these teachings say that realizing this, appreciating this, is the beginning of egolessness. When we find ourselves in the midst of this vast, great sphere of being, instead of imagining ourselves with our little likes and dislikes and picking and choosing and preferences to be at the center of it all, when we let go of that and we begin to open out into the larger reality, then instead of ego, we are experiencing the opposite end, humility. Humbleness. It's humbling to really feel this, to really experience this. The Shambhala teachings say not only is it humbling, it is also joyful. Because we can only feel gratitude for being able to participate in this gift. This life, this mystery. So, to summarize, really we're talking about why we practice meditation. Our likes, our dislikes, our opinions, our interpretations, our evaluations, our critiques, our judgments are all just thoughts. And yet they become the stuff out of which we construct our identities and cling to them. It's that clinging that is the activity of ego. That is the trip that ego is on. It is grasping and rejecting. And it's so busy assembling this identity out of all the stuff that's arising and falling away, and basing it on likes and dislikes, creating ourselves and the world with the thoughts that we cling to. That's what we see. That's basically what we see every time we sit on the cushion. What we see is that our thoughts and feelings, they come and go, but we tend to grab onto them. And when we grab onto them, they tug us away into the whole forest and quagmires of stories, narratives that we then use to spin more of our own, to solidify ourselves, fixating, clinging, turning likes and dislikes and preferences into belief systems and ideologies and doctrines and dogma. So the Shambhala teachings begin and end with, according to Sakyong's teachings these days, basic goodness. Basic goodness is what we are left with when we stop clinging, when we let go of those thoughts that hold our likes and dislikes and our preferences and our picking and choosing. When we can let all that go, what we're left with is basic goodness. It's who we are. It's who we are without our belief systems and ideologies and critiques that divide and separate us. It's our capacity for experiencing the world as one whole sphere of being and ourselves as not separate. And it's intrinsic to who we are. Not just intrinsic to who we are, it is who we are, and it's what we share. It's what we share, it's what we have in common with each other and with those other 7 billion people alive right now, participating with us in this moment. So it's basic goodness that can dissolve that thick line that we draw down the middle of the page. The basic of basic goodness means basis of transformation. Because as we let go of thoughts, as we let go of our opinions and judgments and likes and dislikes, we can see more clearly who we are and what the world is, really. Because we're no longer stuck in this delusion of duality. Our hearts open and we begin to experience ourselves as part of this larger sphere of being. We begin to realize that wholeness is more real than any concept or idea about it. We are simply alive in this moment. No longer separate from life itself. No longer separate from a life in which nothing is excluded. It's all right here, right now. To be experienced, because the living energy that's flowing through you is the same life energy that's flowing through me. And that life force that animates us is the same life force that animates the dog in the pub and the kittens on the farm and the elephants on the plains in Africa and the trees in Riverside Park and the coral reefs in the oceans. It's no separation. Just this. What more could we want? Thank you for being here tonight. A special thank you and welcome to our friends from Korea, Buddhist nuns who are here for 3 weeks, is it? And do you come from one monastery or different temples and monasteries? Different? Wow. Well, I'm sure you'd be happy to talk to people afterward. Or is there anything you would like to say in terms of your own experience and practice, practicing the Dharma? As full-time professionals. No.
I'm sorry, I think we are always beginners, so I don't think we are professional or something.
I know. You know, I'm teasing you. I'm teasing you because we talked earlier, and we have a good friend in common, Professor Hun Kyung Chung, who teaches at Union Theological Seminary, is a feminist Christian theologian who is also a Dharma teacher. And her history in the Dharma goes way back. So that's interesting thing happening in Korea is this dialogue between Eastern and Western religions. Korea, very important for that. If you have any thoughts on this that you'd like to share, please.
Thank you for a fantastic talk. And everything that you said felt, you know, imminently true. Mm-hmm. Something that I have trouble with, though, is what is the distinction between the sort of the discernment and the choosing in the kind of narrow sense that you're talking about, mm-hmm. we need to sort of work mm-hmm. with, and a proper discernment. Say I come up against a situation that's quite dangerous and I want to make a choice between, you know, someone mm-hmm. taking a dangerous action and a positive one. I still find difficulty not seeing the first as an example of the second in some mm-hmm. cases. So what's the difference, and how do I sort of, mm-hmm. how do I not still feel like actually, no, I should be able to discern, I should make choices, you know,
yeah.
and therefore justify the state of mind I'm in?
Good question. I think it's a key question. What is your own sense of it? Just stay with that for a second. How do you differentiate or discriminate between what's of consequence and what is just picking and choosing, as the poem says?
yeah, hard to put a finger on, but I guess in this context, I'd say there's a strong meanness about the first one somehow.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts on that? How we tell the difference between what matters and what doesn't really is the question, isn't it?
I just have something small to say. You were saying that there's a line of two sides. And I was reading recently that there's like a dark side and a good side, and the dark side don't want you to succeed spiritually, you know, like in your Buddhism.
Mm-hmm. Buddhism is trying to address that dichotomy that we often set up between good and bad and right and wrong. You know, it's trying to say, look, this is all of a piece. That division is just happening in our own mind. And it happens in many little ways every day. You know, what we like and what we don't like, because we're trying to weed out what we don't like so that we can have a life of ease or comfort or pleasure or happiness or whatever, you know, we're holding up as our criterion for making these little choices. And the problem is that we're not aware that we're doing it unless we have a practice like meditation that allows us to see how much of our psychic energy is going into trying to get rid of what we don't like, weed it out of our lives, you know, get rid of those people, find a new partner, however it may play out. Yeah, right here?
Yeah, I guess following on the first question.
How to tell the difference.
Well, I understand and am familiar with the concepts you talk about very eloquently tonight, and I appreciate it. The question, I guess, for me has been, I see how those principles that you outline work internally, but, you know, is there a conflict or a place where one needs to find a place to stand ground and look at injustice and work mm-hmm. toward addressing what one sees as wrong in mm-hmm. the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I've always seen some confused about that connection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you hit on, I mentioned earlier in Korea, this dialogue between Buddhism and Christianity, and it pertains to Judaism too, Jewish Buddhist dialogue, Christian Buddhist dialogues. The Abrahamic traditions bring with them this prophetic understanding that revolves around justice. And you know, setting at liberty those who are oppressed and being intentional and active. And Buddhism historically has not been as socially engaged. Is that fair to say? So out of this dialogue is a very fruitful exchange in which each is informing the other. Do you need to become peace in order to make peace, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say? But maybe once you become peace, then you need to get busy making peace, you know. So anyway, yeah, it's critical. And I mean, engaged Buddhism these days in America, Shambhala talks about creating enlightened society, which is very much about becoming involved in the momentous issues of the day. And Buddhists all over the world are being engaged in ways that historically perhaps they haven't always been.
Your talk really hit home for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've been politically engaged, I guess we would say, mm-hmm. In various practices pretty much my entire life on a minor level. But the political process for me has been a source of losing many friends, family members, colleagues, being very involved. So as I say, these days, it's an election year. And so as a result, I try not to get as involved with some people, knowing usually where they tend to stand. And I think what I took from your talk on a certain level tonight is not that one should not be engaged, not that one should not make a choice, but it's the clinging. It's the absolute certainty. It's the closing off of the other person and their views that can arise when one's ego gets involved and one must be right. And that's the essential takeaway that I think you've left me with.
Thank you for underscoring that. That is the key. Yeah, it's not so much about content as it is about clinging, holding on to one's own position.
At the moment, I'm feeling like a dog chasing its tail, because I'm sort of going in circles about bouncing off the first question and in trying to discern different assessments that arise, I guess, about things. And
different what?
Like assessments of...
Yeah, assessments.
Sense of, like, I'm toying with this phrase that constantly comes around of, not in Buddhism, but, you know, being your authentic self.
Yeah.
And obviously, which is sort of oxymoronic in Buddhist perspective. So I guess I'm like, struggling with identifying certain factors that I wouldn't cling to about my perceived sense of self that's not ego-driven. Do you know what I'm saying?
When you know the last part I missed.
Well, it's like being ego-driven. It's just like what this, you know, when, if, like myself, I think that I am a certain way. Is that ego-driven?
Yeah.
As opposed to actually, do you know what I'm saying? I'm worried about being ego-driven.
Yeah.
In
and how to tell when it's ego and when it's just kind of authenticity. Manifesting.
Yeah.
You, when it's your authentic self or when it's when it's ego-driven. Yeah. Anybody got any insight into that in terms of how to really feel that difference or know it in a way that is somewhat reassuring? Right here. Thank you.
Well, like you said, you know, our world is really, our perceived world is really our own projection of these good or bad, the duality that we project onto the world. And I think it's important to remember that we're responsible for that. You know, that is our own self projecting those feelings outward. And we project... When we project that little self, it becomes about the good and the bad. You know, I like this, I don't like that. And to answer that question, I think if we keep in mind that, you know, that good and bad, it's insignificant to the connection we hold with everyone. There was a moment when you said there are billions of people participating in this moment. That really felt expansive. And to confine ourselves to these good and bad things that we define, to confine ourselves to that small little bubble seems ridiculous, right? The world is so much more expansive and is so much more than, you know, what I'm defining it as. That's not important. And I think if we strip that down and remind ourselves that, you know, how much less conflict there is when I don't worry about those things, and how much less energy I spend in my day when I'm not avoiding that conflict, I'm letting it go, and I'm not trying to define my world or define my problems, but by letting it be to a certain extent, I feel like is how we can navigate those situations.
Thank you. Good summary. We want to break now, if it's okay. You guys, we're a little past 8:30. I want to be on time. So many thanks to you guys for coming tonight. And thank you.
Thank you, John Engelé, and thanks for listening, everyone. Always, we appreciate it. We appreciate the support. We appreciate your enthusiasm. We appreciate you coming to see these talks in person if you happen to live or be in the New York City area. You can hear these talks live every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. It's our weekly NARMA gathering. For more information in general about our classes and weekend retreats, visit us at ny.shambhala.org. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Tell your friends. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.